Greetings, all my beautiful listeners. It's another week, and that means another episode of the podcast has dropped. Welcome to episode 120 and my delightful interview with Charity Yoro. Charity is my kind of human, and we had such a dynamic and diverse conversation, and you'll notice that I actually talk a little bit more in this interview. I actually also recite my favorite poem very badly, so please try not to judge me. You'd think if I loved it that much, I would be able to recite it so much better, but clearly I have some challenges. Charity is a poet, and she's a Pushcart Prize, an Orison Anthology nominated poet, and she has a debut collection coming this fall in 2023. She's also a creative producer with a strong background in community building, as well as a freelance writer and marketing specialist. But most importantly, she's a mother. And in this interview, what I really love is we talk about the quiet miracles, the daily miracles, the daily magic that I think a lot of us, including me, we sometimes forget to appreciate. And so now, episode 120 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
I think magic is there. Magic is there if you want to see it. And if you want to see the connections, and if you want to see the, I think magic, when I think of magic, I think of mystery. I think of what we don't know and the awe and reverence that comes along with that. The first thing I always say is poet. It's just like the first identity that comes to mind. The second is mother. And seeker is another word that comes to mind, another identity. I would also say lifelong student. Like, that feels really important to me, is continuing to learn in some capacity, continuing to be open to learning. Sometimes I teach, sometimes I facilitate, but I think primarily I identify as a student.
Now, you and I, we had a little bit of a conversation before we got started. And you, I think if I'm hearing you correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, would your ideal job be a poet or a writer of some sort?
Well, you know, I feel like writing just finds its way in my work, whether that I get paid for it or not. But you know, I don't have, like, the ideal job is more for me like a feeling versus like a title. And that feeling is one of balance. It's one of wholeness, meaning. Social justice is a huge part of the work I do, again, paid or unpaid. I also, I guess, returning back to the first question of like identity, like I consider myself like a steward of beings, like, and that is part of being a mother, but it's also part of just caretaking the earth. You know, it sounds kind of like funny, but like I do consider that part of my identity, is like, what are the things that I'm doing in my vocation, in my writing, in my art, that is making the world a better place for my kids and for other kids and for their kids and generations to come. And so I think steward is a really beautiful word to describe that. And I think that is more aligned with like the dream job for me, is like, in what capacity am I, you know, for, as a writer, it is a lot of, you know, writing poems around these themes, but I think it's also bigger than that.
I was going to ask, when you were growing up, I mean, where did this sense of the desire to create social justice or facilitate social justice or steward, you know, others, the world,
into social justice action. Was that part of your childhood with your parents? Where did that come from?
You know, it's kind of funny. I always say like my name Charity just feels like really at times ironic because I've worked in the nonprofit world for so long, or like, you know, for a lot of my career was like in some capacity. Like I served in the Peace Corps in Madagascar and in AmeriCorps in on the East Coast in New Jersey. I did a lot of like service in my 20s and an early career. And like, I feel as if it was, I don't know if it was like my name and that just like that labeling of me as a child maybe contributed to me wanting to do that, or it could also be seen as like a calling in or calling forth, or like a divine sort of, you know, like, oh, a divine naming, I guess, if that makes sense. But yeah, I don't know. My parents were are very strong Christians. You know, they grew up and raised us in faith, and they've always sort of positioned a sense of, in Hawaii, we call it kuleana, a responsibility toward others and toward, you know, beyond us, like in the world, like a sense of responsibility, shared responsibility is what I'm thinking of. And my brothers are also, like, my brother is a muralist and he deals with art in its natural form in the world. And I think of him because I think that we share a lot of similar values instilled from our parents, you know, about creation and about responsibility and about accountability and deep connection to the earth and nature. And
when I was in seminary, I thought it was so fascinating because we did a lot of deep dives in various classes into parts of the Bible. And of course, Genesis might be the most famous book in the Bible. And I always thought it was fascinating that in Genesis, you know, God urges these creatures that he's created, human beings, to steward the earth and take care of the plants and the animals and all of this stuff. And it's fascinating within Christianity that some people see it as truly stewarding and taking care and passing laws so the pollutants don't get in the water, the Clean Air Act, you know, the Clean Water Act. And others see it as, oh, we're supposed to shape it to our will and use it in a way that benefits us. Might not necessarily benefit the animals or the trees, but God said to do this. And I find that paradox in thinking about that passage in Genesis absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Because it just shows that different humans, and yes, there is Christianity is a huge tent. It is a huge tent.
Yeah.
Lots of different people in it. It's always been fascinating that, you know, human beings, do we understand and decipher the passage through our own lens? Of course we do. Of course we do. But maybe we also understand its meaning through the, you know, what we want it to say. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot about, I was just thinking about, as you were saying that, like interpretation and like how even like just relating to how someone might read a poem that I wrote, or I might engage with a poem differently than someone else. And it's all like subjective, you know, it's like you're bringing your frame of experience and biases and also intention. And I mean, when I think when you're talking about those two maybe different views on stewardship and like dominance, like I do think that there's still like it feels as if those things are both rooted in the same desire for perhaps wanting the best for self and family and community, but maybe approaching it in a different way. But fundamentally wanting the same thing, or like perhaps encompassing the spirit of God, you know, in that example, in the same way, but just interpreting differently depending on the lens, you know, like the frame in which they're coming into the scripture, like the passage. Yeah, so it's really interesting.
Abrupt right turn. What is your favorite poem?
Oh, that is so hard. That is so hard. Okay, I'm only thinking
maybe two. You can pick two if you want.
Okay, so the one that I just thought of, because she just has her book out and wrote a whole, or there's an excerpt from the book about the poet I'm thinking of is Maggie Smith. She wrote a memoir, You Could Make This Place Beautiful, and it's based on the poem Good Bones, which is essentially Smith talking about the world, its beauty, its terror, and trying to explain it. I'm getting emotional, to her kids, you know, sorry. And anytime I talk about poetry, I get emotional because that's how I feel the words, even though I don't have them on my tongue. But I think about that poem a lot, and about the hope and the despair that can be held at the same time, and how that both things can be true. And we can have hope and we can have fear and we can have, you know, despair, terror, all those feelings are valid and can be held together. And it's a popular poem, you know, it got really popular around 2016, I think. So much was happening politically, and just the whole landscape of everything was just, yeah, it was just a huge shift, right? And then she wrote this memoir. And then I'm also thinking about it because I'm in this similar situation where, so she, Maggie Smith was going through a divorce, and a lot of her memoirs about separation. And I'm in that similar situation where I'm newly separated from my partner. And so there's a lot of like intersections there that make me think of that poem. And so right now I'm resonant, that poem is resonating a lot with me. Is it my favorite poem of all time? I don't know. That's a really hard question. I also really love Ross Gay's books, and I don't have one specific poem that I can point to right now, but it aligned with the theme of hope and finding beauty in the minuscule and the mundane, like mundane. I think a lot about Ross Gay. Yeah. That was a really hard question.
Oh gosh. Well, I was just going to say, please don't. I mean, poetry is evocative and powerful when you least expect it. And don't apologize for crying, because right before I left for my trip to Arkansas, I went out with a good friend who loves poetry to death. Okay. And this is the first time she and I are going out, and we're at this fancy place in Santa Fe, and we're talking about poetry. And I love anything that's written. I love people who create things. I love learning about new stuff. So she starts reciting this poem in this fancy place. And it is so beautiful and so powerful that I just start weeping. At the table, I'm weeping, and she's okay with it, of course. But I just thought, you know what? I don't even want to stop. I don't want to stop this feeling that I'm having right now, because this is real and it's life. And it means that I am mired deep in it. And thank God for that, you know? Then we go over next door to have some sushi. And she says to me, oh my gosh, do you know what one of my favorite poems is? And this is my favorite poem. Okay. So I said, I don't know. Tell me. She said, oh, it's by Rilke. And I was like, oh. And I said, I think I know the one it is. She's like, well, let me read it to you over the sushi. So do you know which one? Do you know the first
one?
Oh, God speaks to us as he makes us. Are you familiar with that poem?
Yeah, I don't know it, the whole thing. No. Oh, can you recite it?
My God, if you want me to right now.
Yes.
It is so beautiful. It's called Go to the Limits of Your Longing.
Mm.
God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me, flare up like a flame, and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. And I'm in this sushi restaurant crying because that poem says everything about the soul and the conversation with God before the soul goes into the body and goes into life with all its beauty and terror. It is so, it's like this beautiful goodbye and also benediction from the Creator.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful. It is, I'm actually going to get a parts of it tattooed on my body, but don't tell my mom. Did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like as a kid?
Yeah. So I did. My parents actually met in the church and they married shortly after. And then I came. So I was, you know, brought up literally in many aspects in the church, and our extended family, it was a family, you know, it was my actual extended cousins, my extended family, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents were all kind of involved with the church. And that was our community, you know, that was our community growing up. It was a safe place. When my parents divorced, we did leave the church, but my mom still found community at other churches, and she would take us. And those were the places where, you know, we made friends. I mean, a lot of, you know, formative periods of my life was around the church community or within the church community. And I think there's a lot, I think, that helped us, like us being me and my two brothers, in making sense of a world that felt really confusing and scary in some ways and unpredictable. And there was this pillar of constancy and stability there within both the church and then our, you know, our extended family, which felt like an extension of the church. And now I would say that I identify a little more on the spiritual side. I've had to, you know, like come to terms with some injustices that I feel like happened with the particular church that I grew up in, and some things that happened around that just didn't feel whole, didn't feel right to me. And then in coming to terms with that, sort of finding my own way of spiritual and, you know, faith-based like inquiry, you know, just like figuring out what that path was for me. It took a while. Yeah.
Did you ever go to church camp?
I did.
Craziest thing that happened at church camp.
I don't know if there was anything like, I did have really good, great memories.
I'll tell you one of the craziest things that happened at my church camp for a weekend. They had a contest where, and now that I look on it as an adult looking back, I'm like, this was a bad idea. They had a contest where they were testing people. This is when we joined a Presbyterian church for a couple of years. Okay. And I was with kids from school. How many marshmallows could you put in your mouth? And so it was like people stuffing marshmallows. And then one of the deacon's daughters started choking because the marshmallow had gone down her esophagus and she couldn't breathe. So they had to do the Heimlich on her. And it like seemed to me like it took a while. And then this marshmallow like shot across the room. I just thought, I mean, all the adults handled it with such grace, but as a kid, I was like, oh, something's wrong here. And then I'm like, a few years later, I was like, that was like a bad idea, putting marshmallows in people's mouths. It's just bad news. bad news.
Yeah. I mean, and you remembered it all, you know, like years later, it's like a, you know, secondary trauma. You're like, ah.
I was going to ask you, is your last name, is it, it's so beautiful. Does it mean anything? Is it Hawaiian? Is it, what does it mean? Because I love finding out about names.
Yeah. It's not Hawaiian. It's Filipino. It's my dad's, or Tagalog, I should say. But my dad is Filipino. So it's actually a Filipino name. And I don't know what it means. And it's a great question. I don't know. You know, that is a part of our lineage that I am exploring in kind of right now in a, you know, new part of my work, writing work, is like, just like the colonization of the Philippines and like kind of what was lost there in our history, our family history that has not been really recovered.
I think it's so interesting because before we started our conversation, I was telling you about Santa Fe and the challenges here between the different peoples here. And then you're in Hawaii, where that's also an issue with colonization and what happened there. Now we're talking about the Philippines.
Yeah.
And what happened there. You cannot escape it. Unfortunately, you just can't escape it. There's so much reconciliation that needs to be done within people, within their inner selves and their souls, within families and communities, but also whole countries. The ramifications of the past just continue to echo on. And, you know, you'd like to say, oh, I mean, this is a ridiculous statement, but you'd like to say, oh yeah, Hawaii has done it's reconciled, you know, we've kind of, there's been a deal and everyone's feeling good, but no, each person individually has to find peace and reconciliation, because the things that happened during colonization and in every single place, whether it's Santa Fe or Hawaii or the Philippines or Africa, were horrific, and that kind of trauma just transcends generations.
Exactly. So, that's what I was just thinking, the generational. I mean, I think, that it's very similar. So my parents my grandparents were born in Hawaii, but we are not native Hawaiian. So our lineage is not Kanaka Oʻiwi, which is native Hawaiian. And that is a lot that I explore in my writing too, is about that conflict of being both local and settler, being both the colonized and the colonizer, and in some ways like contributing to that, like you're saying, like the conflict, you know, contributing to some of the damage and also being victim to it in some ways, and having to be in that, we're all in the system, right? We're all participating in some way or affected in some way, and sometimes both at once. So it's interesting. The reconciliation, that's such a great word. And I think of that a lot.
I mean, one of the things I lament, and I use that word lament super intentionally because it's the only word for me that's powerful enough to express the grief and the loss with colonization, was the loss of cultures, the loss of language, the loss of art, the loss of stories. So much creativity, so much identity. And I'm someone who believes that God, you know, God shows up in the world through every single human being. Every single human being is an emanation of that spirit. And God, to me, doesn't want just everyone to be exactly the same, because God's loves showing up in all sorts of different ways. Otherwise, I'm sure God would be bored. God, I think, really rejoices in the different languages, the different kinds of art that humans are capable of, the different ways of seeing the world, the different ways of telling story and deciphering the world around us through song or whatever it is. And colonization in many places just went in and destroyed all of that. And to me, that's just, it was destroying God's work. mm-hmm. for me, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and destroying another way that God used to express their presence to us so that mm-hmm. we could see it manifest in the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, colonization is just horrific on so many levels. But for me, the lament is the loss of song, of story, of language, beautiful yeah. languages. We've lost so much knowledge that we'll never be able to retrieve. So many songs, so many different ways of seeing the world. And it's makes me very sad.
Yeah. And there is a sort of reclaiming happening, I think, in with certain communities that feels, I think, empowering and should be mentioned also is that, you know, there is this destruction happening, but there's also this generation that's wanting to reclaim and to amend and reconcile, love that word, and to, you know, forge a new way forward that's better, even better than what was before, right? I think magic is there. Magic is there if you want to see it. And if you want to see the connections, and if you want to see the, I think magic, when I think of magic, I think of mystery. I think of what we don't know and the awe and reverence that comes along with that. And so when I think about the awe and the reverence, and I think of the mystery, I mean, honestly, this last 2 weeks has been full of magic for me. I'm going through a major life change, and it was terrifying because it felt so uncertain. So like, how could I possibly, you know, leave a relationship with two very young children, and I don't have a job, and I haven't, you know, worked formally on paper with a employer for the last few years, caretaking my children, and in making the decision that was the best one for our family. It was like God, the universe, spirit was saying, hey, you're listening, because I'm going to make things really easy for you. I'm going to get you a place to live. I'm going to get you a job. I'm going to get you the community that you've been wanting for the last 4 years. I'm going to kind of just throw everything in your lap and show you that what happens when you actually listen and attune to what needs to be the alignment that needs to happen. And I mean, this has all happened in the last 2 weeks, these huge shifts. And while, you know, a lot of these things were in movement before the 2 weeks, it's like, it has felt like little affirmations, reminders, magic, you know, these moments of magic that are saying, hey, you're on the right path. Hey, you're doing this right. Everything's going to be okay. And I just feel so grateful and, yeah, emotional again, grateful and, deeply, deeply in awe of that, the synchronicity and just the holding that has happened for me, for my family, my children in the last 2 weeks.
It's really interesting because doing this show, I try to be careful with my words. You know, I use the word God, I use universe, I use spirit, but sometimes I use the word, the words, the soul of the world. Mm. And I get that specifically from the book, The Alchemist, which everyone out there should read because it's astonishing. And, mm-hmm. you know, we might, faced with these large decisions in our lives, you know, should I move to Santa Fe? Should I, for you, leave my partner? In our minds, there are all these roadblocks, these huge walls, or maybe you could picture it as this massive crowd of people that are just standing in your way, this insurmountable obstacle. And the soul of the world, when it asks you to step forward in your life or move forward, and then you're seeing all these insurmountable obstacles, but you still make the choice to go forward despite the obstacles, it is almost as if the soul of the world just comes in, walks in front of you, and just pushes everybody out of the way and clears a way through the crowd. Because you're living an authentic life and you're on the right path. I mean, if you are doing something that is so scary, but it is the path that the soul of the world wants you on, it might test you. Yes, of course, everything's not going to be hunky-dory all the time, but you will find that all your obstacles are gone. Reminds me of what Joseph Campbell said in Living a Life Full of Bliss, you know, in Living a Blissful Life. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to paraphrase here, but if you're living an authentic, blissful, bliss-filled life, you can look and there might be a wall in front of you and everyone else will see a wall, but because you're living a life with intention and integrity, a door will open for you. And you are the only one that can see that door, but the universe has opened it for you and you can step through. And I've always thought that was so beautiful because that's absolutely my experience and a lot of other people's I've talked to. And it sounds like for you too, in these last 2 weeks.
That really resonates. And I say last 2 weeks, but you know, it's honestly, these moments have been happening, you know, like throughout my life. And you it's like, are we going to attune to seeing it as magic, or, you know, it's just coincidence, or no, all these people are coming into our, and circumstances come into our life for those reasons. I love that. I love that quote by Joseph Campbell and that analogy.
I mean, I think one of the things that's hard about our world is there's so much suffering and sadness and sorrow and death. And I'm in a super privileged position. That doesn't mean that I haven't seen my share of sorrow and death and suffering, because I certainly have had a lot of that in my life. But I've worked on it. I continue to work on it. I've worked through it. Sometimes I think back to where I was 20 years ago, and I'm astonished that I'm still here, frankly, because of what I went through. And I am in a privileged position, but I worked really hard and didn't give up to be in this position. I did not give up. Every person on this planet has a purpose. I think you know this. And so once you start understanding that and you're like, oh, I'm here to do something for other people, for the planet, for the stars, who knows? At this point, for the multiverse, if we want to get all matrixy, I think, you know, that in itself, understanding that is a call, don't you think? Yeah. It's a call to start trying to understand how you can be good to other people, to the planet. I feel like I'm on a soapbox. Sorry, everybody. But it's really important for me that, you know, every single person understands that they're beloved and that they're here to make this world a better place. I'm going to ask you a confounding question just because I'm curious. And there's no judgment, but just only because of what I think. Do you think there is a hell? And I might edit this out. Do you think there's a hell somewhere else? Or do you think it's like here and it's our job to make it better? Thoughts?
Ooh. That is a confounding question. Okay. In some ways, I feel like the latter. I think the years of the pandemic have felt like a little bit of that. Like, we are creating circumstances that feel like hell, you know, like as humans, we're making decisions collectively that are not benefiting the whole, that are not benefiting the earth, we're not being good stewards as a whole. And it feels like a form of hell. Like, it feels like hell being like punishment and hell being like consequence for sin or consequence for wrongdoing or misusing of resources, misusing of gifts. So yeah, I kind of like am aligning and I'm feeling like the latter of what you said is kind of what I feel right now. Like, it's a responsibility now to take us out and to do what we can within our limits of longing, within our limits of rectifying some of that, some of the bad decisions.
I think the one thing that I love especially about that poem, and I love that you brought it back in, was I was in an event last night, and it was a storytelling event. And we each had to tell a 3-minute story of a moment in our lives when we suddenly became aware of the awe and wonder of the world around us, something that just gobsmacked us. And this woman who was there talked about being a kid and being, I believe, in Jordan when she was a child. And, you know, they were out in the middle of nowhere in Jordan, but near the mountains. And they built a big fire for everybody who was there at this encampment. And just the way they were situated and the way the light was reflecting, the little girl who was like 7 maybe stood between the fire and the mountains, and she was dancing, and her shadow on the mountain was huge. They could see her shadow. And so that brought up that poem, right, that I recited earlier, make big shadows that I can dance in. And I just thought, oh my God. And I think about what you've just said about, you know, the pandemic and hell. And, you know, if we were all dancing like that, making those big shadows and rejoicing in the light, the firelight, and rejoicing in life in whatever way that looks like, you know, this world would be a better place. I think it would alleviate some of the feelings that there is hell on earth. I love what the Catholic Church said, because they always hedge things. They're hedging. There is a hell, but we don't know if anyone's there. I thought that is fascinating. Because you're not really saying anything definitive. You're kind of just imagining. But I thought, is that double speak? I can't quite tell what's going on. You know, there's such an authority, but for the, for the Catholic Church to admit that, I thought was very fascinating. So I walk around this world thinking, you know, hell is here, and it's what we create, whether it's in our own minds, you know, or it's with the people around us or at our company where we work or what have you. And it's each of our responsibility to act in this world or create big shadows that God can dance in. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. At the end of the credits, I will recite the poem by Maggie Smith, the one that Charity talks about and that is potentially one of her favorites. I'd like to thank Charity for being a guest on the podcast and for sharing her stories and for being willing to have such a lively conversation with me. I also need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode. That Sounds, Music L Files, Justin Allen Arnold, Stephen O'Brien, Frank Schroeder, and Winnie the Moog. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to changemakers, artists, playlists, and other groovy things I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Charity. Live in the flow. Believe in the flow. And understand that every minute, every interaction, every moment is itself some kind of miracle. So before I recite the poem, Good Bones, by Maggie Smith, I want to let my listeners know that there might be some language that is difficult to hear or triggering for some of you. So now, the poem Good Bones by Maggie Smith. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children.
the world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every love child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I am trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful.